Like so many others, I remember that moment when I was first induced to slurp down a freshly shucked oyster. That so many of us remember that moment leads us to ask, what is it about the oyster that leads us to become its cultists?
Welcome to the award-winning Food Chain Radio Show with your host, Michael Olson. And now get ready for 1 hour of What's Eating What Radio.
Hello out there. You are tuned into the 1,423rd edition of the Food Chain Radio podcast. Or hey, perhaps you're among our friends up there in Quebec City who are tuned in as we stream along in the Food Chain page at metrofarm.com. Well, whoever you are and wherever you are, welcome aboard. I am Michael Olson, your host for this hour of What's Eating What. Folks, I was recently engaged in trying to present a cogent argument to a young adult as to why they should eat their first freshly shucked oyster. Now, if you think about it, that's one tough job. For example, if the eyes are first to feast, how would you describe the appearance of a freshly shucked oyster so that your naive target's mouth would water at the prospect of slurping that oyster down? Well, what does that oyster look like but a big, wet, slobbery booger? Ew! Now, how about the smell? Kind of like a sock you fished out of a slough. Ew! Perhaps that is why Jonathan Swift said so long ago, he was a bold man that first ate an oyster. Yet you and I were induced to eat that first oyster, and now we are card-carrying members of the oyster's cult. And so we ask, what is it about that oyster that leads us to become its cultists? Well, who better to ask than Virginia Schaffer, who is the host of Lady Oyster Blog and the author of Oyster Society, Adventures with the Shellfishly Motivated. Welcome to the Food Chain, Virginia.
Thank you, Michael. I'm so happy to be with you today.
Okay, before we move on, let's talk first oysters. Yours?
Mine was with my grandparents. And way back then, we used to buy oysters in a ball jar, believe it or not, already pre-shucked. And we fished one out of the ball jar, put it on a saltine cracker, topped it with cocktail sauce, Tabasco, lemon, salt. And then I added another saltine on top and ate it like a sandwich. So that was age six.
And I suspect you must have had a funny look on your face when you finally swallowed that thing. Tasted that wonderful taste of the oyster going down. Remember that experience, what you felt like when you first ate it?
Yeah, I think that there were probably a lot of toppings on that oyster to taste too much of it. But there was obviously a lot of salt and cheering from the grandparents. So I was really proud that I impressed them. I'll put it that way.
Well, good. My first oyster... Actually, my first oysters came in the same jars yours did to our home in Montana, where my father enjoyed them immensely. But us kids looked at the oysters in the jar and would have nothing to do with them at all, much to the happiness of my father, who ate them all himself. So I never did have my first raw oyster until I was broadcasting the Food Chain from a farmer's market here in Santa Cruz, California. And one of the purveyors of the market was Oyster Bill Callahan, who's a great big, huge man who would sit behind a long trough of ice, fresh oysters still in the shell. And people would come in and belly up to his bar and he would shuck the oysters for them. And they would eat them right there and they would line up and for the oysters. And so he brought some to the booth where I was broadcasting. And he said, Michael, it's time for you to taste an oyster. And so there I was, live on the radio, couldn't turn him down. So I let one slide right down my throat. And it was amazing. I'm sure I must have had a funny expression on my face, but it was such a wonderful experience. And I don't know what it was about that, but it captivated me. And I'm in its hold ever since. And you as well. You made a life out of the oyster, but you weren't always the oyster lady. You were also working in the travel industry in corporate boardrooms. What were you, how did you make that transition from the corporate boardroom to the oyster lady?
I started working, I was in DC at the time. I started working in corporate travel. I was on a plane every single week. I did go to some very interesting places, so I did love being a part of the travel industry. But in sales, I quickly realized that I had made my job my entire world, and I didn't have any hobbies. So I was just quite trying to figure out what kind of creative outlet I could make for myself. And I had all of these really wonderful memories with my family having oysters. And it was always this, what I call a background prop in my story, where they were always present. And I just felt like maybe this oyster, maybe there was something here that could create and make for a really good story.
Well, I always think that there's a moment when you realize, like Newton had the apple that fell on his head and he realized it's gravity. There must have been that moment when the apple fell on your head and you realized it's the oyster.
There was. I was at an Island Creek Oyster Bar in Boston, and I was looking at the menu. I'd opened it up, and on the menu were not just the oyster names, were not just the locations, but they also had the names of the farmers on all of those associated with every oyster. And I started thinking, God, oysters are getting so cool. What's going on here? How do I get to know the farmer? I don't know who caught my salmon. I don't know who caught my trout or lobster. I don't get to know that, but I get to know it for oysters. So that was my aha moment. Like, there's something here. And getting to know these people is a very different world. And maybe I can figure that out.
Kind of like being in the travel agency. You open up a
True.
pamphlet on ways to go for your travel adventure, and there's your oyster farmer.
It's so true, travel just brings so much adventure, so much curiosity, and it felt the same way. Although I will say, this kind of adventure, there was a lot to do in New England for me when I was living in Boston there, but I would start coupling my oyster adventures with coastal meetings and, time a meeting on a Friday so I could go visit an oyster farm on the weekend or a Monday. And so it became a really good way of doing both, I'll be honest.
So, and then with respect to having different oyster farmers, that would signal a real change in the oyster world. I remember my father eating oysters in the jar, and of course you wouldn't know where they came from or anything, but you're talking about a world where you actually get to know the oyster and its farmer. I always say the best food in the world is food with its farmer's face on it because you can actually look into the farmer's eyes and see what's in the food. In that way, all the oysters are an adventure, each from each different place. It's kind of an adventure.
It is, it is. And what we're learning today is that oysters taste so different from where they're grown and what kind of natural elements they're taking on. So it is just this most curious travel opportunity for everyone to go and try an oyster on a different coastline and see what that expression is. And so I think that's really where we're starting to see new appreciation coming into our modern oyster renaissance.
And as you traveled around the country, did you go? I'm assumed you arranged some meetings in like New Orleans and maybe San Francisco and Seattle. So you got to taste your way around the country that way, correct?
I did so much around the states from, Canada all the way on down, Charleston, Louisiana, the Florida Panhandle, upwards Seattle, California. So got through my sort of North American coast, but also I was traveling overseas. So I was traveling to farms in France, Ireland, visiting places in England, even as far as Shanghai in Thailand. It's very interesting.
And in each of these locations, the taste of the oysters reflected the place in which you were having the meetings then.
Absolutely. And, we have different species on different coastlines as well, and those bring even more complexity, and differences in taste. The phenotype, which is sort of the shape of the oyster and what it looks like. So there's so much to observe and admire about oysters on different coastlines.
And from these meetings, you started to think of them as a subject of your writing, something to write about, an adventure in travels.
It really was. And it's funny, when I started this blog, I didn't know anything. Didn't know
This
how they were farmed.
blog being.
The Lady Oyster blog. I started this because Oyster Lady was taken, so I just switched the words around, made my own. But I was in sales, so I had started this adventure by just calling up an oyster farmer in Wellfleet, Massachusetts, asking him if I could just come in and see what the farm was like. And it was just so funny because he responded, "Well, it's January. What are you doing? What do you want to see in January on an oyster farm in Wellfleet?" And I had no idea. But there I went, and we stood in cold, cold water on Mayo Beach, and we were shucking oysters, and our hands were freezing and shaking. And I just had never felt more alive in that moment. And that's just when I knew that the stories were on the coast.
And you ended up pursuing that as a source for your, that was the beginning of the blog. And what about the beginning of the book?
I had started the book about 5 years after starting the blog. There were a number of people that I was really interested in talking to after a lot of my adventures, and I kind of squirreled them away for these moments where I could ask them some really important questions. And it was just so true that when you meet people on the coast and you hear their stories and where they're from, we have ex Wall Street financiers that have turned to oysters. We have artists. We have all sorts of this shucking community who are so hyper focused on this animal. All sorts of people, marine biologists who touch this animal, that I was finding something deeper happening with oysters and this food system that I hadn't seen anywhere else.
And that would be the cult of the oyster, of which you're the first lady now, because you have the blog and you wrote the book, and that makes you the first lady of oysters. When we come back from this break, I'd like you to take us on a quick tour around the country and tell us about the different geographies of our oysters and what they mean to you and who you met on your travels. As this is going to be a great adventure. Ladies and gentlemen, this is Food Chain Michael Olson with Virginia Schaffer. She's the oyster lady now of American Oysters and has a lot of great stories to tell. So stay tuned because we're going to pick them up when we come back from this quick break. This is the Food Chain.
Let's go back for more of what's eating what on the Food Chain with Michael Olson.
About 1,000 editions of the Food Chain Radio ago, which was quite some time, I interviewed Mark Kurlansky, who was the author of a book entitled The Big Oyster, in which he said that New York City should not have been called the Big Apple. It should have been called the Big Oyster, because that's really what New York City was founded upon, a bed of oyster shells. And that was Manhattan Island. And what about that wild oyster that upon which New York City was built, Virginia Schaffer? Do we still have wild oysters?
We do still have wild oysters. We've lost a lot of our reef systems around the country. So the modern oyster industry looks a little bit different today, but it has gone through centuries of change, and just incredible histories that are not always quite linear in every location. I think we've seen our oyster rise and fall with really key moments in even American history.
And some of the falls were caused by what?
Well, Lots of it came from overharvest of the oysters, diaspora of people, disease, outbreaks with industrialization, and war. So this oyster, this animal, is so intrinsically tied to our way of life and how we've changed over centuries as well.
Like much of agriculture, it runs in parallel with us then.
Truly, truly. And it's funny when you look at history, it's kind of like, well, how far do you want to go back? Because for thousands and thousands of years, our oysters, our native oysters on the East and West Coast, were a primary food source for so many First Nations. And I always kind of, when we look back at stewardship of oyster beds and culture, it really starts there. And also then introduction when colonies came around, when the gold rush happened out west, and red light district booms, in New York, in Cajun culture. So there's so many pieces to America and our very unique histories on every coastline that are tied to oysters
And people.
and people,
And people.
truly.
And so that's the movement of people and the development of various diasporas and their tastes and everything have a great impact on I guess the native oyster b colonies and the beds and where they lived. Now, like so many other things, other marine life forms they tend to get overfished, correct?
Yes, they do. And we've seen so much of that around the country. If we do go back to looking at the gold rush, we have a very special oyster on the West Coast. It's called the Olympia. And this is our only native oyster. And it's a very finicky little oyster. It grows in tiny little inlets, doesn't like really strong currents. And when the gold rush came about, the Salish tribes were using this as basically a way of trade with some of the settlers there. But what happened was the oyster was so delicious, people were so, I guess, overzealous about eating them, that it really wiped out all of the Olympia beds. And one oyster, just believe it or not, one oyster during the gold rush went for today's $25. And so when we think about just sort of how overzealousness of a particular seafood can decimate certain areas, and that's what did happen there, and certainly in other places, as Mark Kalansky alluded to in The Big Oyster around New York.
Is New York still a big producer of oysters?
It is. The Long Island Sound has an incredibly impressive industry. Most people will know the Blue Point, which has its own very unique history. But we lost so much of the oyster beds during settlement times. And I think it's a good lesson learned. Today, what we're seeing is so many people coming into restoration work, which I just love seeing. In New York, for example, we have the Billion Oyster Project, and their goal is to restore the New York Harbor with billions of oysters. And they're doing a fantastic job by getting, school-aged children into learning how this process works. So I love seeing how our modern times are really taking advantage of figuring out how to fix the problem, and how when we take away something from nature and put it back, just how much we're protecting ourselves even from a shoreline point of view.
I was noticing that the other day on a quick walk to a local lighthouse, and how there was a beach plant restoration project that was bringing back native plants that had once thrived along the coast, and they were beautiful in a coast kind of way. They didn't look like pansies or anything like that. They were really rugged kind of plants that it would take to live next to that environment, but people were bringing it back, and it was good to see. And we hope we can do as much of that as we possibly can. From New York, so the you have the big Blue Point oysters in New York that really made New York famous. Take us down south a little bit to the Chesapeake Bay.
Yeah. So if we look at history there, fascinating as well. And even from a colony's point of view, the Algonquin is the main nation there from an indigenous point of view. They were actually, before the colonists came, were already doing sustainable practices around oyster beds where they would only harvest the large oysters. They'd preserve and protect the smaller ones. So they'd have this constant supply of oyster consumption. They introduced our settlers to this food, and we also saw some oyster over-harvesting that began to happen. But over the history of the Chesapeake is really, really fascinating. Even as you move through the Civil War times, we're finding, and there's a lot of sort of work around this and study, but Black maritime history was huge. So the sailing up and down the eastern seaboard of Black seafarers, we've lost a lot of that history, and there's some good historians who are working to basically to ask our current and our very last Black seafarers of some of that history that we do have. But there were also oyster wars. Maryland was the first state to have an oyster navy that would go up and down the Chesapeake Bay and protect oyster beds from looters who would come overnight and harvest. So we just have this rich history in every body of water. It's incredible.
In more recent times, we've also had a history of, you spoke of the industrialization of agriculture, and there's been a lot of chicken farms along the Chesapeake Bay, and animal agriculture that have really had an adverse impact on the waters of the Chesapeake Bay. And there was a big fight about how to manage that. Have we come to grips with that with respect to the oyster?
There's still ongoing conversations on the Eastern Shore and the Chesapeake. It's not easy for everybody to really be successful there, and there needs to be a lot of teamwork and a lot of good policy. I think what really started our modern renaissance around oysters was the banning of DDT and fertilizers. We go back to the 70s there, and the Water Quality Act, a lot of that and being enacted to clean up our rivers and bays. And that's what really spurred all of this incredible regeneration of our shellfish beds, of aquaculture starting out. So it's just this hand-in-hand process of figuring out what's good for our water, what kind of runoff is happening, and how can we prevent some of those things.
Pretty much the same thing is happening on the West Coast here in the Tamales Bay area, because you have these wonderful dairy farms along the slopes of the Tamales Bay, and so you have fertilizer runoff into the water, and so it's been pretty tough. They're actually kicking the oyster farms out of the area when it gets right down to it. Because of that. Have they figured out how to have a good oyster industry in the Chesapeake Bay, given the runoff situation?
It's all about, working with the state and figuring out where water quality is at its best. There are some incredible farms down there now, oyster farms
Good.
that are thriving, and bringing in some new practices as well. So we've got the old long line, we've got floating cages, and most oyster farmers will work with a certain state body. It's different from every state to state on identifying where those places are, where oysters are going to be successful. And starting there is a really good starting point. And then, of course, it's all about how can we engage our neighborhood? How can we have some social licensing around this to get people involved? And that's where we see cool projects happening. In the Chesapeake, they have a really strong gardening program where, as waterfront homeowners, you can get a gardening license for oysters and start growing your own in bags and cages. So there are ways that education and sort of engaging coastal communities is helping keep our waters clean, helping know how to manage septic tanks and runoff and all sorts of things that might affect our waterways.
Well, something you always think about when you eat an oyster, because that's what oysters do. They lay on the bottom of the pond and filter water, correct?
They do. They do. And, you know, there's a lot of misconception, though, around what is retained in an oyster, what's not, how they're converting certain things in the water. So we think of them as filter feeders, but in reality, what they're doing with excess nitrogen is transitioning that into a gas, and they're pulling out carbon from our water and using that to build their shells as calcium carbonate. So there's a lot of fascinating filtering that an oyster is doing to actually clean up our waters and lead to some other keystone benefits.
They're kind of a good keystone creature too, because if they're thriving, then your water is thriving, correct?
Yeah, it's sort of, you know, it's one of those double-edged swords where oysters need good water quality, but oysters also create good water quality. There was an amazing study done in Stamford, Connecticut, where they quantified the value of the oyster aquaculture industry and the clam industry. And it was saving the town of Stamford millions of dollars a year in nitrogen removal services from the water. So when we think about these industries and how impactful they are, even to our own tax dollars, it's really impressive.
Good. And moving along down the coast into Florida, what kind of oyster business exists there?
Ooh, in Florida, in the Gulf is really where we prominently see a lot of that oyster industry. A long, long-standing traditional fishery of wild harvest. So this whole area was rich in oyster beds. We look at Apalachicola being a huge, huge town for oyster processing. You go further into Louisiana and Texas, and we've just got this incredible array of oyster beds. You know, in 2020, wild harvest of the oysters there was actually banned in Florida on the panhandle. And a lot of that was still over harvesting. And we've seen that in the Gulf with other fisheries, right? Mm-hmm. There was a lot of that happened over the last 20, 30 years. So that gave rise to aquaculture, where we could start growing these animals versus taking from our beds and giving them a bit of a rest to recover.
When it gets right down to it, that's probably been the big evolution in the oyster industry, has it not? Been the transition from the wild harvest to the cultured harvest to the farm.
It has been.
From hunting and gathering to farming.
Yeah. Yeah. And, you know, when it all started, it sort of happened after the water quality was enacted more strongly in the 70s, right? And then we had this a ton of grant money that came out from the U.S. government to get more seafood in the American diet now that we were cleaning up our waterways. And so all of these marine biologists flocked to the coast and they started figuring out how we could grow oysters and do other things with aquaculture to grow these animals. And it created a lot of clashes between traditional wild fisheries and this aquaculture, which they called, you know, big business moving into the coast to grow oysters. But
because it costs a lot of money to set up the infrastructure.
It did. There is a lot of work, licensing cages, all sorts of like hatcheries. We need to grow these animals. So there were some really cool projects that happened on the coast. But really, when we think about it, it's just fascinating to see that kind of the opposite happened. A lot of small scale farms started popping up along our coastlines, and it allowed for families to get involved and have their own small business.
Well, that is a story we love to hear, that there's room for the small farms and for people in the industry. So, well, ladies and gentlemen, when we come back from this upcoming break, I'd like to take the opportunity to steal our guest and have her take us on an epicurean tour of lot of eating the oyster because that's what she does. So we're going to have a first-hand tour, an Epicurean tour, an Epicurean tasting of the oyster, and pair it with some good wines and go from there. This is the Food Chain, Michael Olson, your host, with Virginia Schaffer, who is the host of Lady Oyster Blog and also the author of Oyster Society Adventures with a Shellfishly Motivated, which is me and you, and especially Virginia. So stay tuned. We will be right back.
So much to say, so little time to say it on the Food Chain with Michael Olson.
This from one of my all-time favorites, Ernest Hemingway, in his A Movable Feast. Get this one sentence. As I ate the oysters, with their strong taste of the sea and their faint metallic taste that the cold white wine washed away, leaving only the sea taste and the succulent texture, and as I drank their cold liquid from each shell and washed it down with the crisp taste of the wine, I lost the empty feeling and began to be happy and to make plans. That, ladies and gentlemen, is a taste of the oyster from Ernest Hemingway. And with that taste, I like to turn to another great writer about the oyster, Virginia Schaffer, host of the Lady Oyster Blog and author of Oyster Society, Adventures with a Shellfishly Motivated. Who are the shellfishly motivated, by the way?
I think they are curious, adventurous people who, live their lives for food versus the other way around.
Yeah, a long time ago, when I first started this radio blog, this radio podcast, whatever the heck they call it these days, it started out as Saturday Morning Agriculture. And people come up to me and say, "Hey, Wilson, I love your show, but I don't have anything to do with agriculture." So I changed the name to The Food Chain, and nobody can escape that. So who listens to the Food Chain? It just tends to be people who are interested in what they eat. And the oyster is one of the most interesting things to eat. And I'm so grateful that we have Virginia Schaffer to take us on a tasting tour of the oyster, because that's what she does from her headquarters there in Maine. Where are you in Maine,
I
Virginia?
am in Bath, Maine, and I am the owner of Lady Oyster, which has become a culinary tourism business.
Good. And what does a culinary tourism business do?
Well, we're kind of creating our own lane in a sense within oysters. We have a couple different incredible experiences for people to engage with this animal. The one on the one side, it's our sensory dining, which is taste appreciation. And we, just like a wine tasting, go through the story behind the oyster, nature, process, ecology, down to the people and taste. And we pair that with really nice wines. And on the other side, we get people out on boats where they get to go to an oyster farm, learn how to shuck oysters, handle the product, just like I did that very first time that kind of changed my life. So the goal is to meet people where they want to be, whether it's an adventure, whether it's more around taste.
Now, I would suspect that you being on the East Coast and relatively close to a couple of very big metropolitan areas, New York City and Boston, that you would have a lot of people wandering up your way, curious about an Epicurean adventure with the oyster.
Yes, we do. We have so many people who come up to see us from our major cities, and we love it because it just reminds me of that time when I was such a curious consumer and I wanted to pull back the curtain on an industry. And so we're facilitating that for those who really need to get out of the city, need to understand food better, and also just just really be inspired by a coastal lifestyle.
Well, okay. Our audience will now belly up to your oyster bar. Lead away.
Well, what we love to do with our guests is we take them on a journey, and we start by telling them where the babies come from. And we talk about
the babies. Modern,
the babies. Yes, the oyster babies. And we walk them through kind of how everything happens today. You know, we're no longer tonguing reefs. So how are we growing these things? And that always sends to a really good conversation. And then when we get into taste work, this is all spearheaded by a new organization called the Oyster Master Guild, of which I'm a part of. This was founded in New York, and it's very similar to a wine sommelier program where there's levels of study, taste work, hospitality work, and testing. So we apply those skills as certified oyster specialists with our guests. And a lot of that is like how to taste an oyster, which most people have been indoctrinated either through like shooter culture or, you know, swallowing it whole, or they just don't think about it because oysters are always had when there are festive moments. So you don't take it slow. We make sure they take it slow.
And how is that?
So if you guys want to know, I would suggest anyone at this point of the podcast to grab some oysters and shuck them and have them ready. And this is where taste appreciation begins.
Okay. We have all done so and we're ready.
So just like a wine tasting, you first want to eat with your eyes. And Michael, I remember at the beginning of this podcast, you describing what that looks like, but I'm going to give you a very different perspective.
Please do.
So when you eat with your eyes, looking at an oyster, there's a couple of things you want to notice. First is a nice glossy sheen on the oyster. You don't need it to be swimming in a lot of brine, but that gloss is a beautiful sign of hydration and a healthy animal. You also want to look for meat to shell ratio. This is another thing where you want at least the meat inside to take up about 3/4 of the shell.
Oh,
It's a sign that they're eating well wherever they're growing. And then lastly,
if there's just a little meat in a big shell, bad sign.
It just means that there's still good minerality in the water that oyster is filtering, but it might not be getting the nutrition it needs to continue.
Okay, good.
Mm-hmm. The last thing to look for with your eyes is the shuck itself. And this is really where we are changing things through the guild. You want that oyster to look as if you took that top shell off without disturbing the animal at all. Meaning nothing should look pre-chewed. It should look like no puncture in the meat, a nice perfect little teardrop, a perfectly intact little belly, and a nice adductor muscle there. So we are big on the shuck here. We want you to have a good experience with a raw seafood and texture. So after you've eaten with your eyes, you move into aromatics. Are you ready, Michael?
Okay.
The next step is to give the oyster a little sniff test. Things you should look out for.
As you would.
As you should. Mm-hmm. You definitely want to search for off notes, which is anything too fishy or sulfuric. You do not want to be smelling your oyster. But instead, a nice ocean breeze, algal notes, maybe some vegetal notes that come off, or nothing at all. That's a good sign of a fresh oyster. The next step is to take a sip of the brine. People forget to do this, but there is something that happens in your mouth. That olfactory sense is engaged. Your taste buds begin to salivate. That salt is an enhancer for flavor.
So just a sec, As Hemingway said, and as I drank their cold liquid from each shell and washed it down with the crisp taste of the wine.
Exactly. Exactly. I mean, he knew what was going on way back then. And this is important. It really prepares you just like salt does on any food, it enhances flavor. So sipping that kind of gives you an indicator already of flavor that the oyster is going to provide. And then lastly is to eat the oyster. And I say this, please chew your food. It is important. There are a crescendo of things that happen when you chew an oyster. You are going to have some creamy notes, some firm textures, some sweetness that comes from the adductor, maybe even some bitterness that comes from the gills. So as you chew, you're going to experience new things that happen. You don't have to chew it forever. Just a few bites is just fine. But it will release some really special notes. And that's how you take advantage of eating an oyster properly and its flavor.
Wow. Your description would probably work on me better than my description would work on anybody. But then you have different varieties of oysters to taste, correct?
We do. We have so many. Even within Maine, we have over 150 oyster farms. That is more diversity than any other state in the country. And so many rivers and bays that give off different expressions, different minerality, what they're eating, phytoplankton, algae, detritus, salinity in the water that changes, storms that bring in something new. So this animal is not like a vintage. You don't bottle it and know what an oyster tasted like in 2019. It is forever changing. But I love the oyster because we can stay in the present with that flavor and not have to worry about how it should taste.
Wow. And when you lead people through tasting, you have what, four, five or six oysters there in front of them? Is that how you would do it?
Yeah, what we do is we have typically three different oyster farms in Maine coming from three different bodies of water. And we challenge people to taste those differences. We provide them with tasting journals so they can write what they're tasting. We have a tasting wheel, believe it or not. So we have more vocabulary beyond salty and sweet. And then in between all of that, we use a map. We identify these places and what's happening in the water and talk a lot of gossip about our farmers, which is the most fun.
Ah, give us a taste of the gossip.
Well, let's see. We love to just talk about personal anecdotes because we know all of these people really well. We've learned to get to know them, their families, their personal stories, their silliness, things that they're passionate about outside of oysters. So we have people who are artists outside of being an oyster. We have others who were former Olympic rowers and sailors, Wall Street folks who got into it for a different life, and families who have really learned to help their partners with a startup business. So all of these things end up bringing out some really cool conversations.
So often said in my book, Metro Farm, that each small farm is like is as unique as a thumbprint on the land. No two of them look exactly alike. They're all different and all unique. Could the same be said of the oyster farmer?
Oh, definitely. Oh, they are all so different. The person is so different, and also the farm. You change how you operate a farm based on the waters in which you work. And that can be deep water. It can be shallow. It can be rough. It can be calm. The gear changes. The animal itself, no two oysters look the same. So on such a micro level, we see so much personality in every one of these farms.
It sounds like eating oysters in Maine could be a never-ending adventure.
It is, and I don't think I will ever find the end. I always say my favorite oyster is the one I haven't tried. It's the one that will
Next, what's
continue
next,
to
right?
elude me. Maine is huge, and I think people don't realize it has more coastline than California, contiguous. And even as a person who lives in Maine, I feel like I have barely scratched the surface. So just imagine all the oysters awaiting us up here as well.
What is the one thing that's the most important in tasting your first freshly shucked oyster?
A lot of people fear texture, and I completely understand that. So, what I love to tell people to do first, there's two things, two gateways. One, sipping that brine is an incredible introduction. That saltiness is something we're all familiar with and we really enjoy. So that's always a really good way to take it slow, slow it down, try the brine first. I have guests who have been introducing their children to oysters, and the children just sip the brine and nothing else. But it's getting that familiarity with ocean flavor that's important. If it's texture that's an issue, I say grill them. Get a compound butter. I love chili crisp, butter and a little mild cheese on top. Shuck the oyster, put those things on top of the oyster, and put them under the broiler in the oven for 7 minutes. It is the most glorious thing you will ever eat. And just get a good slice of bread to sop up everything. And I promise you, you will like oysters if you start with butter.
As is true with just about everything. And we enjoyed Virginia Schaffer with butter too, because she is the host of Lady Oyster Blog and the author of The Oyster Society, Adventures with a Shellfishly Motivated, which we all are now. Virginia Schaffer, thank you so much for joining us. Look forward to visiting you in Maine for sure.
Thank you, Michael. I'm looking forward to having you.
All right, bye-bye, everybody. Thanks for tuning in.
You've been listening to the award-winning Food Chain Radio Show with Michael Olson. And if your friends missed the show, tell them to log on the Food Chain page at metrofarm.com for a listen. Now, go out and find some food with its farmer's face on it and live.